Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Tonight we'll be in Psalms 26 and 27, and I hope you'll turn there with me. I want to give a thought to you before I read 26, and I want you to think about your own Christian life. There cannot be an attachment without a detachment. There cannot be a drawing to something without a drawing away from something else. Let's see what we're talking about. King James has the word judge. Mine has the word vindicate. I think the word judge is probably better, although the idea is that God will judge in the affirmative. It's the idea of David calling God to judge the motives and actions of his heart. If you look at the first discussion question in Psalm 26, is David being self-righteous in this psalm, boasting of his integrity? The whole answer to that question is based on what the word integrity means. In English, the word integrity has to do with a man's personal character, his ethical norms, how he conducts himself. But in Hebrew, the word behind the English word integrity has a slightly different coloring. It is the coloring of being, it's the coloring of wholeness. As over against someone who is, say, partially committed to God or half-hearted committed or apathetic, David is not saying, look at me, boy, I don't have any sin at all. He's really saying, God, look at me and see that I live in a wholehearted kind of commitment to you, even when I sin, you know, even when I'm wrong. I come to you in a purity of heart, really the word integrity in Hebrew would be a purity or sincerity of heart and mind, not so much a perfect standard of life. Therefore, I think we see better what David is saying. He's saying, God, look at my faithfulness, my motive. Now, in your translation, I want to remind you again, how is the word, O Lord, how is the word Lord spelled? Is it a capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D? If not, what is it? Is it a large L and the rest in small letters? Now, mine is unusual. It has a large L, and then it has smaller letters, but the rest of the letters are capitalized. Now, why is this word, Lord, put in that kind of an unusual kind of letters? Why is that it's capitalized? The deal is here, it goes back to the Jews afraid to pronounce the covenant name for God. Now, with linguistic analysis and comparative with the Aramaic, we think that the way that when they did pronounce the covenant name for God, the name that God gave to Moses at the burning bush, is not Jehovah, but Yahweh. There is no J in Hebrew. There is no such thing as Jerusalem or Josiah or any of those J's. They're all Y's. There is no J in the Hebrew language at all. So Jehovah for sure can't be right for that because there's no J. Yahweh is probably the way when they pronounce it is. It's the four consonants. Y-H-W-H. Hebrew doesn't have any vowels. Originally Hebrew just had consonants. When the Masoretes in about the 8th or 9th century A.D., after Jesus' death, tried to save the Hebrew language from distinction, they put vowel points back in the Hebrew. When it came to this four-consonant word for the covenant name for God, they didn't know how to pronounce it. And they wouldn't have pronounced it if they could have. So they took the vowels from the Hebrew word Adonai, which is the Hebrew word for Lord. Took the vowels from Adonai and put them in the consonants for Yahweh. And that's where we get the word Jehovah. And so that's why it's capitalized from it. This is the covenant name for God. And every time in your translation, that little word is spelled like it is right there. That is the covenant name for God. And it'd be a good habit for you in your Old Testament, because sometimes the word Lord is used, Adonai, and it's not spelled like that. This is the word Yahweh. So write YHWH over this word. And every time you see it spelled like that in your translation, put that there, because that is the special relationship between God and His people. The covenant name for God. Now that's very important, because then in verse 3, the word loving kindness is the verb that goes along with that special name. It's the word hesed. It's translated in King James, mercy. My translation calls it loving kindness. The emphasis there is unchanging love. I will never, no, never, no, never forget Israel. That's the promise, it says. The God of Israel, the special verb that relates that God to the people. Unchanging love, loving kindness, mercy, hesed. So it's very important. You can see David is speaking from inside the covenant, inside a personal relationship with God. Now, I want you to turn to 1 Kings 9:4, if you would. 1 Kings. Just run back through if you find Kings. And I was at a pastor's retreat one time, and a guy, we both had the same Bible, and you know how preachers are. He said, turn to Obadiah 2:2. Obadiah. He started flipping back there. We didn't know where it was, you know. It's real. So he pointed and said, so, don't worry if you can't find him. Nobody else can. Well, look at 1 Kings 9:4, and you'll see that God used this word integrity of David, a holiness. And as for you, if you will walk before me as your father David walked, in integrity of heart and uprightness. And you see the word there? You can tell right there the word is not a man, but it is an adjective. It's describing how David walked, the integrity of his heart, of his uprightness. It's the attitude he has. So put the first king there by that word integrity, and you'll see he's not bragging about this. I have trusted in the Lord without wavering. Now the idea of here without wavering could refer to one of two things. It could mean that David has not wavered in his faithfulness to God. But syntactically, or the way the grammar is put together, it could as well refer to God. It could mean that God has not wavered. And therefore, the unchanging kind of love can be paralleled by the idea that God has not wavered. He loved David the same today as he loved David the first day David committed his life to him. Even after Uriah and Bathsheba, God had an unchanging kind of love for David. And so I think I don't know, it's a talk. It can mean God or it can mean David. I think both of them fit very well. He's unwavering. Now, examine me, O Lord, and try me. These words for examine and try are words that come out of metallurgy. They mean the testing of a metal to see if it's pure. The burning off of the dross so the pure metal comes. It's an ideal, the same way as God tested Abraham, not for Abraham to fall, but for Abraham's faith to be increased. You see, it's the idea of testing so the dross will be removed and the man will be pure, more mature, more like the nature of God himself. Now, test my kidneys and my heart. Does that sound right? Well, that's what the Hebrew has. It has kidneys instead of... My mind has mind. Now, tell me, when the Hebrew used the word kidneys, what was he saying? He wasn't saying mind, by the way. Well, when you tell old Marcus you love him, you say, Mark, I love you with all my heart. If you were a Jew, you'd say, Mark, I love you with all my kidneys. Kidneys were the seat of the emotions. Now, it's the heart today. And the heart was the center of the intellect. So what he's saying is, test my emotions and my intellect. He's saying, look and see if my emotions are right, if my mind, my thinking, my theology, whatever you want to call it, the way I look at you is right. Tell somebody, let me know all your kidneys. That'll bless them. Now, the next verses 3 through 6, is going to list 6 characteristics of David. He says about himself. There's going to be 3 positive and 3 negative. And I want you to find the 3 positive and 3 negative. Put a P or an N beside these next few phrases and see if you can find the positive things, the negative things David's going to say about himself. Verse 3. For thy loving kindness is before my eyes. What does that mean? Okay, he can only see it, but he sees it hour after hour, day after day, whether he's at the work. I don't know if he's in a team going to work, but if he's on the throne, or he's in the bedroom, or he's having dinner at the table, God's mercy, God's special unchanging love is always on David's mind. I want to tell you this. You know, it's real true that if we meditate on the things of God, I mean, during the day, when we're at work, just think about the things of God, you'll keep yourself from more sin and evil and temptation every morning. Thinking about the things of God, the promises of God, maybe even memorizing scripture, you know, filling your mind, keeping it before you all the time. That's what it's saying here. Continually thinking about God and His mercy. I think it's kind of like Paul praying without ceasing. That doesn't mean, you know, bow your hands fold your hands and bow your heads. It means an attitude of prayer. Same thing here. Attitude, always God on your mind before you. And I walked in thy truth. What does the word walk mean? And when it doesn't mean physical walking, lifestyle. The word saying, my lifestyle is in thy truth. It means I live in accordance with what I think you want me to do. That's what it's saying. I do not sit with deceitful men, nor with pretenders. Now, here's two kind of men. And I want you to realize these two kind of men are not somebody, David, just some old bum out there, but these people may have been someone who could have helped David politically. He maybe could have made an alliance here, or made friends with these folks, and consolidated his kingdom. They may have been political allies, but he would not identify with them for two reasons, two different kinds of people. One of them, now my translation has the word deceitful, but the literal is the word vain. And the word vain is the same word as the word nothingness. It's the word that's used for idols in the Old Testament. So what it means is these people have they don't even pretend to believe. They're just, now when it says worthless men, you think it means they're morally bad, no good. But worthless in the Old Testament means they had no faith. They were completely devoid of personal commitment to God. They didn't pretend to be a committed Christian or committed, not Christian, but a committed saint or Old Testament believer. Now the next group of people, these pretenders, are the hypocrites. These are folks who pretend to have a faith, but who really do it just for show. It's just kind of a social thing to them, or it's a pretending, a playing a game, if you please. Two kind of people. Those who don't even pretend to have faith, and those who just pretend. David says, I won't associate with them. I'll not walk with them. I'll not go with them. Now, number five. I hate the assembly of the evildoers. What is an assembly of evildoers? Well, it could be anything. It may be just a gathering of sinners. Now, for what they do, David doesn't say. He just says, I don't want to be a part of that. And I can make all kinds of things where people get together, and the whole motive of getting together is something besides righteousness. And I'm not going to tell you what kind of get together, because you just decide to yourself. Sinner's hand. Well, that's me thinking, I think of an old pool hall. And I love it. So I would have translated my way. Get around that one. Nor do I sit with the wicked. Now, the idea of sitting with the wicked could possibly be the political life of the Old Testament was centered around the gates of the city. That's where the elders of the city went to judge, you know, and that's where the people took their court cases, and that's where the people discussed. That's where Absalom turned the heart of the people against David. That's the gates of the city. He sat there and talked to these folks. It may be that David says, I'm not going to go and sit down with these evil folks who are planning their strategy and running their government the way they say it. I just won't do that. I won't participate in that kind of thing. Now, if you find six of them there, you find three negative and three positive, I hope you did, because I ain't going to tell you. Verse 6, I shall wash my hands in innocence. What could that possibly be? Wash my hands in innocence. Put CF in your under I. Put CF, Exodus 40, 30 through 32, and you'll see that this may be an allusion to the idea that the priests washed their hands, the laver was between the tabernacle. David's going to say, I come with with an offering and thanksgiving and praise. Maybe David is using a symbolic form of how the priest used to wash himself. He's saying, I've washed my hands in innocence, and that's the whole essence of the sacrifice, of it, to wash your hands in innocence and then to bring something to God. I will go about by an altar, O Lord. See the idea of the altar coming in, the laver was between, before the altar. You had to be pure, innocent before you got there. Verse 7. May I proclaim with the voice of thanksgiving and declare all thy wonders and miracles. The Jews never got tired of saying, man, you should have been there the day the Red Sea parted. I want to tell you, you should have seen the eyes of those Jews. You got that big. They never got tired. Every Passover time, they told a story. All during the feast, they told a story. Let me tell you what God did for us in the past. The manna, all the rest, they recounted over and over and over again. Now, verse 8 starts a new section. O Lord, I love the habitation of thy house, the place where thy glory dwells. Number question number one. What is, when the Old Testament speaks of thy glory, what is it talking about? Excuse me? Yeah? The Shekinah, the cloud. Remember the cloud? Lit up the desert by night, covered them from the sun by day. Came down the house of God when Solomon dedicated. Came down the tabernacle to speak to Moses. Remember? Remember, we haven't seen it kind of in a long time, have we? You know when it's kind of left? Remember when the people grumbled against Moses and God said, I'm going to take my Shekinah away. Now, I'll put my angel back with you, but I'm not going to travel anymore. Well, the only time after that the Shekinah ever came down was when Solomon built the temple. And when Isaiah had the vision, he saw a house filled with smoke. That's Shekinah. See, man can't see God until God's presence comes in a cloud that man won't die. That's the kind of the glory. The Jews call the kebab. Now, what is it, when it says dwell, what does it mean, you think? Where does the kind of glory dwell? Where did it manifest itself in the Jewish religion? Well, on top of the mercy, between the cherubim, above the mercy seat, right? That's where the blood was sprinkled once a year, the Day of Atonement. That's where the presence of God symbolically dwelt among the people, like that. That's why nobody could enter the Holy of Holies except the high priest once a year. And later on, the Jews tied a rope around his leg and put bells on his bonded robe. So in case he died in there, struck dead because he did something wrong, or God wasn't pleased with attitude, they didn't want to wait outside all day. So they heard the bell tinkle. They knew he was putting the robe back on, and he was alive. They didn't hear from him. They just started pulling on the rope and drug him out to his death. So why? They didn't want somebody to die here because nobody could have gone after him. So they were really upset. This presence of God was very holy to them. Now, I think it's talking about the Ark of the Covenant there when it says dwells over the top of the cherubim. Verse 9. Do not take my soul away along with sinners, nor my life with men of bloodshed. Now, what is a man of bloodshed? Name me one sin that could be called a sin of blood. Murder, right? And there's others that were punished by death, which is almost everything in the Old Testament. David must have wrote this before he got the heart for Bathsheba, huh? Because I will tell you what, this is very important for us. David became a man of blood. Did you know that? He became a murderer. He became an adulterer. But you know what? You see, it never was David's integrity that made him right with God. It was always God's grace toward David. Because even after David was a man of blood, God still called him a man after God's own heart. A friend of God. Never was David how David lived. It was always the nature and person of God. You see? Okay. Now, you see the little word, verse 11 again? But as for me, I shall walk in my integrity. What does integrity mean? One word. Excuse me? Okay, motives of what you guys have done? Okay. Wholeheartedness, maybe? Sincerity? Wholeness? Okay, faith in the right, if you defined it the right, you know. Okay. Now, look, notice that he says, I'm going to walk in my integrity, but notice the next verse. David wasn't trusting his integrity, because he says, redeem me and be gracious to me. The King James has mercy. Even in David's integrity, he still had to have God redeem him and God be merciful to him. See, David wasn't trusting his integrity, but he did want to be wholehearted before God. He wanted to be sincere. And that's what God wants from man, a sincere heart. Verse 12, my foot stands on a level place. Why the big deal with level place? What is the deal with that? Why, you know, what does that mean, level place? Exactly. And look down at verse 2 in that psalm. My adversaries and my enemies, they stumble and fall. Look down at verse 11 of Psalm 27. Lead me in a level path. Remember the words for sin in Hebrew? Crooked, miss the mark, twisted. It's the whole idea of falling. Lord, took my feet out of slippery places, out of miry clay, and planted me on the rock. See, their idea of moral had an idea of walking. You see, walking is lifestyle. To slip was to commit a sin. To have a level path, to walk straight, to be on the rock. In an ethical life, a life of purity. So that's why all these things of level places and don't let me slip and miry clay, that's why all that's caught up in an ethical context in the Old Testament. Now let's go to Psalm 27. And I want you to read this, and we're going to go about 7 minutes over tonight. That's okay, because I want to finish this song. We can do it. I want you to read Psalm 27, and I want you to find out where the drastic change in mood comes. What verse is changed? And then, read this. I want you to entitle the verse both halves. There's two different halves, two different moods, and I want you to entitle them and find it when you read through it. So read through your translation. There's a drastic change of mood. People said, oh, it's two psalms put together. Friends, if it was two psalms put together, would you be the dummy to put two psalms like this radically different together? David just was a moody kind of person. I think David wrote both these psalms. And it breaks at verse 7. Verse 7 starts the moody part. 1 through 6 is the faithfulness, the joyous part. And let's go through it very quickly. The Lord is my light and my salvation. This is the only place in the whole Bible God is called by the title, God is light. My light in the Old Testament. And I want you to think for a minute the great fear that the ancient world had of darkness. The darkness was controlled by spirits. The darkness was man didn't venture out of his own house. The darkness was evil. Man couldn't control it. Little flickering lights, all they had. Friends, to say God is light is to say the most powerful thing about the deity of Israel. He is light. He is perfection. He is holiness. As it says, he is without shadow of turning. Man, you can see everything. He doesn't hide. Now, look at, you see, I put some, this Isaiah 60 and Micah 7, look those up when you get home. Look at some. It says close that God is light, but it doesn't exactly say, nowhere is the title, God is light, except right here. Now, of whom shall I fear? The Lord is, now the literal word here, mine has the defense of my life, but the word is stronghold. Now, what is a stronghold? It's either a real tower in the bulwark of the city wall, or it was a place where the shepherds built a big rock tower to go in at night and hide from robbing thieves and things. He locked the door. He was safe in there. And that's how God's people are in God. Of whom shall I dread? All that the psalmist is saying is in parallel. He's saying, look, if God's for you, who can be against you? Where have you heard that? That's Romans 8:30. You say what? This is the expression of the psalmist's belief that there is nothing and nobody in all the created order stronger or more powerful than God. And he was right. The devil is not as strong as God. We do not believe in a dualism, right? He's big, but he ain't that big. Okay? Verse 2. When evildoers came upon me to devour my flesh, my adversaries, my enemies, they stumbled and fell. Ethical ideal of falling. Verse 3. Though a host encamp against me, my heart will not fear. Though war arise against me, in spite of this, I shall be confident. Verse 2 is the past. Verse 3 is the future. David says, I have confidence in God. I've looked at my life in the past. I've seen the wars. I've seen the enemy. I've seen it, and I trusted God through that. And though the war come again, I'm going to trust God in the future. The past, verse 2. The future, verse 3. Beautiful, beautiful. By the way, verse 3 is saying this. I will not put my eyes on circumstance. I will put my eyes on God. As long as you keep your eyes on God, you will have peace. The moment you put your eyes on circumstances, you are going to sink in the ocean. And Peter knows that all too well, right? Keep your eyes on God, not where you are, is the key to peace. Now, verse 4. One thing I have asked from the Lord that I shall seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, and behold the beauty of the Lord, and to meditate in His temple. This has possibly three meanings. You take the text. What does it mean to be in thy house all the days of my life? What does it mean to see the beauty of the Lord? What does that mean? Number one, it can be, God, keep me faithful. Always, God, let me be joyful to come to thy house. Don't let me backslide. Don't let me fall away. Keep me true, O God. That is the beautiful New Testament doctrine of the perseverance of the saints. That it is God working in you to do His good will, you see. God's in you. He won't let you fall once you're here. It may be that. Faithfulness. Keep me faithful, God. Number two, it may have the idea of eternal life, like the 23rd Psalm, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord forever. It may mean eternal life. If it does, it's a rare glimpse in the Old Testament of a faith in God that went far beyond His contemporary faith, far above that. The Old Testament doesn't have much about the afterlife, much about resurrection. Daniel and David, only ones I ever saw. Maybe Job, but those are the only ones. Now, the servant can be this. It can mean, God, keep me secure that my enemies may not either kill me or take me away from this city where you dwell. This may have been set right in the middle of Absalom's rebellion. David may have been fleeing from God's house, running out of Jerusalem. He says, God, the one thing I do ask you is, keep me close to your temple. David thought God lived in that temple, and David wanted to stay close to that temple. Now, here's the word temple. In that fifth verse, last one, verse 4. Why do I have the word temple? What little red light goes off in your head when you see the word temple when you're talking about David? Little warning flash that starts blinking. Beep, 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 beep. It doesn't? What's wrong with the word temple? There wasn't one. Temple? Well, it really should be, it's talking about the tabernacle. And I've given you verses before where the temple is talked about in the wilderness, when it means that this is the tabernacle, this is the tent, not the building. The building didn't come to Solomon. So when it says temple, it's talking about the tabernacle, the tent where God dwells. And I think it's Absalom's rebellion we're talking about here. So, from a day of trouble, he will conceal me in his tabernacle, in the secret place of his tent, he will hide me. Now, some say this means that David's going to hide in the Holy of Holies. Can you see David hiding behind the Ark of the Covenant, you know, peeping out to see if the enemies are coming? This is not literally him hiding in the Holy of Holies. This is saying he's going to have confidence in the presence of God. He's not going to sneak under that tent and hide in there. Nothing to eat in there except showbread, and who wants to eat that the rest of your life? Well, last of verse 5, he will lift me upon a rock. Now, what does it mean when we say the rock? Who are we talking about, or what are we talking about? Number one, Psalms 18:2, it says God is the rock, right? And then, over later, in the New Testament, state, when Moses struck the rock in the wilderness, who was the rock in the wilderness? According to Paul. Jesus. So here we have a dual combination of deities. God, it means rock. Jesus Christ means rock. It's a way of saying Jesus is divine. It's a way of saying that God is our foundation, our surety. Now, the radical switch comes in 7, and I just want to say a couple of things about the last part. Notice it says, do not hide thy face from me. Do not turn thy servant away in anger. What's the idea here? David's saying, God, don't hide from me. Don't go away from me. Now, we know that's theologically incorrect, don't we? What's theologically incorrect about God hiding himself from us? The problem is our personal sin hides God from us. God never leaves us, right? That's why the beautiful poem, The Hound of Heaven, is so true. God will not leave his creation alone. He loves us. He will never leave us or forsake us. The deal is, David's personal sin and doubt caused him not to feel God's presence. When people come in and say, boy, I just don't know if my prayer can get through the sin, I haven't lived out. I always go back and say, tell me about when you accepted Christ. Well, I know I accepted Christ, and I just don't know if God accepted me. You see where the doubts are coming from? They're not doubting what they did.
They're doubting who God is. You see? God is the one who is with us, will not leave us nor forsake us. Personal sin cuts off our emotional response to the presence of God. Okay?
So it's our leaving God, never God leaving us. Level path in verse 2 again, over in the last part of verse 13. In the land of the living? What does David mean by the land of the living? Is he talking about heaven? Read verse 13. Is he talking about heaven? He is not talking about heaven. He is not talking about the day of the Lord, judgment day. He is saying, I have a deep personal conviction that God is going to right the wrong in this life. Now what this saying is this. The Jews didn't have a developed sense of resurrection, heaven, another life. What they did believe, they believed in the faithfulness and the justice of God. They said, somehow God is going to work this thing out where even if Job is sick and all that, it's going to work out. David is saying, somehow in this life, in this realm of existence, God's going to make things right. Now that may be the millennium, or for me it is the fact that this kind of created order is going to be what heaven is. There's going to be trees and rocks and bears and fish and lamb and little kids are going to lead them around and snakes are going to be playing in the kids' arms and won't hurt them a bit. That's heaven. In this realm, God's going to make it right. Not in some spiritual thing only, but here and now too. In this realm of existence. Okay. I enjoyed that. I like these two songs. You have to remember that some of this stuff is repetitive, and when I go over things again and again, it's mostly to help you get it, because I want you to remember it. Once you get some of these concepts down, when you read them, light bulbs will start going off in your head. It'll just bless you when you start reading this and seeing those.